Nosotros tomaremos todas las medidas necesarias para que los asesinos del niño ruso reciban el castigo más duro posible.
Maxim fue adoptado junto a su hermano Kirill por la misma familia de Texas y preocupa mucho su estado. El menor vive ahora con su padre adoptivo y es visitado por su madre adoptiva una vez a la semana. Ambos niños fueron acogidos por Alan y Laura Shato en noviembre de 2012 y solo dos meses y medio después, el 21 de enero, se produjo la muerte de Maxim. Ya han empezado las movilizaciones para que el hermano del pequeño Maxim pueda regresar a su patria de origen. Además, se están estudiando las cuestiones de legitimidad en torno al proceso de adopción. No hay que olvidar que tanto Maxim como Kirill fueron adoptados en el mismo orfanato en la provincia de Pskov que el pequeño Dima Yakovlev, un menor ruso que murió por culpa de sus padres adoptivos estadounidenses y que dio nombre a la ley que entró en vigor el pasado mes de enero y por la cual los ciudadanos estadounidenses tienen prohibido adoptar a niños rusos. La muerte del pequeño Maxim se une a una larga y trágica lista de 20 niños de origen ruso que han fallecido a manos de sus familias adoptivas en Estados Unidos en los últimos 17 años. En Rusia, la Cámara Baja del Parlamento ha invitado al embajador estadounidense en Moscú para discutir sobre las adopciones internacionales. Nicolás Sánchez O'Donovan, RT, Estados Unidos.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Los invitamos a visitar nuestra página blog en pueblossinfronteras.wordpress.com, donde podrá opinar y encontrar más detalles sobre las noticias de Estados Unidos, América Latina y el mundo desde una perspectiva progresista.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM.
FreakRadio.org.
And that's who we are, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3. I'm Robert North, and coming up shortly is Bathrob Spears Broadsides. That's my show. Go on from the next 2 hours, and we're going to be focusing specifically on the City Council's recent shenanigans around a needle exchange. And I will have a special guest in the studio with me who will soon belly up to the mic and identify herself. Just who are you, madam, and what is your name?
My name is Emily Auger.
Hey, Emily, and we'll be back with you in just a moment after, I hope, a brief musical break. Interesting. We're going to be talking today about not just about the general realities of a needle exchange and needle distribution, but also about the specific situation in Santa Cruz. And I'm hoping to have you listeners call in at 427-3772 and 469-3119. Again, 427-3772 and 469-3119. And, tell me what you think. Ask questions. We have, not only will Emily here be doing her best to advise us on not just her best information about needle exchange and distribution, but also her sense of the history of it all, some of the local controversies, and like that. So, should be an interesting show. Don't go away. 427-3772. You can also email in at rnorse3@hotmail.com. And I will pick up your emails. Hopefully. The show is going to be archived at huffsantacruz.org. That's huffsantacruz.org. And that's where you can find it as well later on, in case you want to look back and accuse us of this, that, and the other, or possibly learn from what you've heard or double-check what you've heard. Let's see if we can begin with a little music. Yeah, I think we got a little music lined up here. And we'll take it away. Also hoping to hear from Penelope Jernberg. Am I pronouncing her name correctly?
I think the J might be silent.
Jernberg?
I usually just call her by her first name.
Penny, if you will. She was with a needle exchange for a number of years. She was an intern on the program, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Is that accurate? Mm-hmm. You're nodding. And she's out of the area right now. She's operating out of Reno, as I understand it from her emails. But she really, I thought, put out a very informative letter, which I posted on Santa Cruz Indie Media. For those of you who have computers and want to follow this argument in print, sometimes it's you can more quickly and take in more information by reading it than waiting for us slow speakers to talk at you. And so if you go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, that's indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, and you look for the story End of an Era by Steve Plaich, you'll find a commentary. You'll find that I posted her specific concerns, which she expressed in some detail in a letter, which I'm going to actually read part of, and I'll ask for your thoughts on that as well, which I think you've reviewed it as well. And you're nodding.
Yes.
And hey, that's what's planned here for today, as well as a little bit of ancient music from the San Francisco Mime Troupe. So let's roll into that, and then I'll get right back at you. Stay with me.
Chacho, el baile de la caña.
gritamos. Ponte en pie y ofrece tu mano.
So that was a little from San Francisco Mime Troupe from about 30 years ago in one of their many productions. I don't think it was when I recorded surreptitiously on my own little machine while I was sitting in the park listening. They actually did have a few old albums. It's hard to find now. I love the Mime Troupe's music. I'm less satisfied with their local political stances, but... Let's see if we got your mic working here, Emily. Say something into that microphone. Get close to it. Pretend you're having a romantic affair with me. There you go.
It's a very nice microphone.
There you go. Now, I would that I were a cover on that microphone. So, again, the in recent days, in recent months, there's been a surge of what I call hysteria around needles, feces, debris, and well, an environmental concern. And I'm not saying, when I say hysteria, I mean not so much that there shouldn't be a concern about the city's failure to provide adequate funding for needle exchange, which, as I understand, was discontinued in 2009.
State funding
was discontinued.
We don't get city funding.
It's all volunteer for you right now? I mean, all private funding.
Yes, yes.
What kind of funding do you get per year? What's your budget like?
Right now, it's... more than 20, less than 30, around 30,000 a year. That's just for supplies mainly. We don't have paid staff currently.
How did that compare with your funding, say, 7 or 8 years ago?
we had around 10 or 12 years ago when we had drop-in centers in both Santa Cruz and Watsonville. We had multiple paid staff. We had sites every single day, at least one site every single day. We were doing a research project where we were testing people for hepatitis C and HIV and vaccinating them for hepatitis A and B. Our budget was somewhere closer to $1 million a year.
So it dropped from $1 million, and what year did it drop?
Oh, it's been dropping steadily over the last decade. I mean, it sort of matches what's been going on in the rest of the country, economic
downturn. But was it $1 million? What year were you guys getting about $1 million a year?
That was like 2000, 2001.
And then when funding was cut off entirely the year before that happened, about how much were you getting each year?
I wasn't actually working there at that time, so I couldn't give you a number. But, you know, funding dwindled to the point where... it was no longer possible to support paid staff, no longer possible to keep the drop-in center open. That's when the needle exchange became independent again. We started out as an independent entity and became part of the Santa Cruz AIDS Project's Education and Prevention Department. I think that happened in 2003. And between 2003 and 2009, right, part of Santa Cruz AIDS Project. And then in 2009, when the drop-in center closed, became independent again.
What's the impact of the drop-in center closing on needle exchange? How did it actually impact you on the ground?
It was really tragic and awful and terrible and something that we're still dealing with. Being able to have indoor sites, I mean, when we had the drop-in center, we had sites inside the center as well as more remote outdoor sites and street outreach and home deliveries. Okay, so we had a number of different types of opportunities for people to come and exchange, but one of the main things that was valuable about the drop-in center was when you have a safe space to come inside and you're not having to look over your shoulder or rush off or, you know, worry about who's driving past, you can actually get down to business and start building trust and get into some of the deeper issues which people are facing and which we are you know, it's part of our mission to help support people deal with all the different things that chronic injection drug users deal with. And so not having that center means that it's a lot more difficult to have those sorts of interactions occur easily.
I hear you. We have a caller, and callers are always good news when they call in. Actually, sometimes they're very bad news, but it's good news if they do call in. Hey there, caller. You're on the air with Emily and Robert.
Hi, this is Penny.
Hi, Penny.
Wow.
How you doing?
Is it Jernberg or Jernberg? What's the story, Penny?
Jernberg if you're Swedish, Jernberg if you're not.
Oh. Well, what do you prefer to be called?
Usually just go by Penny.
All right. We'll call you Penny. Penny, are you able to hear the show so far, or did you just kind of call in out of the blue?
Just calling out of the blue.
That's
I'm
good.
I'm driving right now, so I mean, haven't been able to.
Yeah, no, yeah. No. I mean, I think you're probably, what, aren't you in Reno or something? Or?
Currently, I am just out of Colfax, so I did drive from Reno, though.
Okay, but you're not going to make it by the end of the show, probably, into Santa Cruz.
No, unfortunately, I won't.
No. But you will be able to actually hear us talking, and people can call in at 427-3772 if they want to ask questions of either you or Emily. I've kind of introduced you already, Penny, as someone who has worked with Needle Exchange as an intern. How long were you with Needle Exchange here in Santa Cruz?
I volunteered with the Santa Cruz AIDS Project for, I believe it was 2 or 3 years before they closed the drop-in center. And then I was with the Street Outreach Supporters for, I think, about two years before I moved up here.
Yeah, you just, you probably didn't hear it because, you know, you can't really, nobody can get free radio beyond a two-mile radius or so, but... Emily, although you can get us on the internet, and you can get us, by the way, for those of you who are listening and want to know, if you go to freakradio.org and then you click on the little red dot at the tip of the transmitter icon, you'll be able to get to the actual hitherto top secret free radio stream, which gets often much more audible than the, you know, listening to it on the radio. But Emily was saying about that fund cutoff, which I asked her about, that it had a very serious and significant impact in terms of cutting off, you know, indoor ability to relate to folks with injection drug addictions. What's your recollection of that in terms of the drop in services and how that impacted the whole process of Needle Exchange?
It was a pretty significant impact as far as the previous operation. The things we were able to provide at the drop-in center, and I don't know how much I'm repeating from what Emily told you already.
No, go ahead.
But the drop-in center was able to provide a safe space, a safe indoor space that was police-free, more or less, unless there's some sort of emergency. We were able to operate with staff and several volunteers and interns to have on a regular basis. So it was a supervised facility. Where people were, everybody was very knowledgeable. We could provide accurate referrals to shelter, food, substance use treatment, medical services. And as well as that, I think one of the really invaluable things that was lost was, you know, a loose kind of form of case management, of being able to have a relationship with somebody in a more or less stress-free zone, you know, where people can get off of the street and take a minute to collect themselves, and we could talk to them and listen to them and you know, build a relationship that way. Whereas in a van, when you're doing exchange and you have a line that's in a parking lot and people are feeling a little stressed out, they're exposed, especially if there's weather, they're exposed to the weather, whatever scrutiny is on the street, and you don't really have the time or the space to have that kind of relationship with somebody. And that was one of the things to me that I felt was the biggest loss. As far as other services that SOS provides, I mean, we're still able to provide, if nothing, I think we provide better supplies because we're able to focus more on that. And the people who run it currently, you know, are able to focus more on the supplies and the needs of the participants. Whereas with the Santa Cruz AIDS Project, there were times when we'd have our hands tied from whatever funding or whatever oversight issues there were, policy problems may have arisen. So that is nice. There is a little bit more freedom within that. But definitely, you know, a lot of other things were lost with that. So, you know, food would be available from time to time. Clothing would be available. There's a place that people could just go regardless if they needed a needle or not. And that's not really available anymore. So that's kind of unfortunate.
Let me cut in and ask, and feel free to jump in at any point, Emily, if you want. There's been, of course, a large attack on needle exchange, although I understand some Take Back Santa Cruz folks are hugging needle exchange volunteers and trying to show great tenderness, sympathy, and love for the individuals involved. But City Council, as you know, went behind the backs of the entire community and shut down needle exchange in the Beach Flats. And correct me if I'm wrong on any of this. Not the Beach Flats, Lower Ocean neighborhood. Something that had been going on for how many years?
Since 1989.
And they did this without any stats from the police department that I know of that showed any increased crime in that area during the period of needle exchange. Now, though it would be, this is what we call reluctant testimony. Do you have any evidence that there was an increase in crime during that period, not an increase in calls for service, because some people see a bunch of people gathering for needle exchange and immediately assume the end of the world is coming, I would assume. Maybe not. Maybe it's more natural. I don't know. But actual crime stats. Do either of you know that there was a rise in crime stats during that period? Let me ask you first, Emily.
I don't know that there was a rise. I mean, one of the tenets of harm reduction is meet people where they're at. So when the needle exchange first came into being, the people who were involved looked around our town and said, where are the drug users? Where are they able to get to? And that was one of the first spots that was selected, because people were already there.
This is a parking lot at Barson and Canfield, or
Barson and Bixby. It's a laundromat parking lot. I mean, the purpose of an outdoor site or a remote site is for it to be relatively low-key. And I think that a lot of people didn't necessarily know that it was happening there. You know, you see a van parked and some people walking past it or staying there for a little bit. It's not immediately obvious what's going on, and that's the purpose, to keep it kind of low-key so that it doesn't attract
People would come to an average needle exchange at any one time? It was a two-hour period of needle exchange, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And there was what was your average population there at any one time?
Easily 20 or 30 in 2 hours.
And you looked sort of like perhaps a Boy Scout gang or a Girl Scout band, or no, you didn't. In other words, you're a group of people. Again, let me try to nail this down and ask you too, Penny. Was there any time did police complain to you that there was an increase? They had reports of break-ins, robberies, assaults, rapes, murders, drug sales, anything in the area around the time of needle exchange specifically?
No, I mean there were times when there would be specific calls made because someone suddenly realized we were there, or maybe something else was going on nearby. But we've never been told that our presence specifically in those specific two-hour slots was causing a rise in crime in those particular two-hour slots.
And Penny, is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, as Emily referred to, there would be calls periodically, but also I would like to note that during that time there was frequent police patrol. At least when I was there, which has probably been at least a year since I did a site, but there was never a night that I was there that I didn't see at least one cop drive by every hour. And sometimes they would park and we would have to ask them to leave because it would make participants uncomfortable. So there was never any question of police presence.
Right.
That was always very ample.
To be fair, that area is part of their beat, so it's
A lot of prostitutes, pretty low-income folks.
And that's been a feature of that neighborhood for many, many years.
Right, but
and
no rise specifically during your needle exchange period of time. And that happened, what, 3 times a week? Was that right?
Yeah, I don't know.
For 2-hour periods
in
the evening.
I don't know that anyone was trying to say that there was a specific rise in crime.
They said that at city council.
Well, I think that the issue was more a generalized sense of, if needle exchange comes to a certain area, that we will function as a magnet, you know, for the drug users, for the drug dealers, for people walking to and from the site, drawing people into the area who would not otherwise be there.
Did you notice increased drug dealing, or was there ever complaints? Again, this is really the same question at the time that needle exchange was at the site.
No, and I lived in that neighborhood for a few years while I was working there.
So did Councilmember Micah Posner. I'm surprised I didn't hear stronger statements from him at the council around this issue, though politicians often run for cover when faced with angry citizens who often have legitimate complaints, as I said, along another line. I think there's a lot of legitimate concerns that the Clean Team and Take Back Santa Cruz and other groups mm-hmm. had about city agencies not providing Sharps Needles containers, not demanding that pharmacies have them available, not sending out crews to parks and to park areas to do better cleanups. Not for me. For me, it's setting up campgrounds, safe campgrounds, so people can actually, you know, use a porta potty and have facilities so they don't have to go take a crap in the bushes,
mm-hmm.
And so that they don't have to run from the police and abandon their property and then of course create a huge, you know, eventually environmental problem of a at least, you know, unsightly, and then, you know, others would say, you know, when and with some justification, has chemical and environmental concerns about that. So, the second issue that came up, and I thought was sort of assumed, first of all, the name of the needle exchange is
Street Outreach Supporters.
Street Outreach Supporters,
the
SOS.
Santa Cruz Syringe Access Program.
The other SOS. But, and not Save Our Shores, but mm-hmm. Street Outreach Supporters.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I should direct this to you, Penny, so you don't feel like you're wasting all your money on a long-distance call.
I'm on my cell phone, so I'm good to go.
Oh, okay. Excellent. The issue of one-for-one exchange or one-for-one plus or needle distribution versus needle exchange. There was a lot of ranting and raving at the city council meeting and at the prior public safety committee meetings about you guys are just, and women are just distributing needles to anybody who wants them, and you aren't taking in the same number of needles, and needles are getting out all over the community. The rising hysteria goes on and on. So
I can,
let me ask Penelope first about this, and she's... want to give her a chance to get in there, and then we're going to hear from you. Go ahead, Penny. What's your thoughts on that?
I definitely have some specific feelings, and I know Emily has a lot to say about this as well. She's got great experience. A lot of what I do is mostly research because I'm in a public health program, and so I get to see a lot of studies done. And a lot of the studies that are done, I mean, I think it's amazing. There is just innumerable amounts of research out there that support syringe distribution, not even a one-for-one plus, but complete distribution of syringes to reduce HIV and Hep C and other communicable diseases. The reason for that, and...
Penny, can you clarify what is one-for-one plus as distinguished from one-for-one and just general syringe distribution? Those are three different things, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so needle exchange implies an exchange. So you get one needle for one needle that you have. Some of the problems with that are if you don't have a needle, you don't get one. Or if you need 5 and you have 2, well, that would imply that you're going to have to reuse your syringes. That has a lot of health complications with them and is often what leads to sharing of syringes amongst people, which is the reason that hepatitis and HIV can become so prevalent. A one-for-one plus would be that, you know, you're working on at a one-for-one model, but if you need more, you can get more, say, up to 10. So you can get, if you have one needle and you need 10, you can get 10. If you have one needle and you need 30, you might not be able to get those. And the syringe distribution would be that you can get basically any amount anytime you need it without having any needles in return.
Now, what was the policy while you were in Santa Cruz working with Needle Exchange? Was it one for one plus, syringe distribution, one for one, or did you simply shoot every third addict who came in? Just kidding, of course.
When I was at the Needle Exchange at the drop-in center that was run by the Santa Cruz AIDS Project, they ran a pretty tight one-for-one program, and that was often because of the police department. They got a lot of pressure from them, and they claimed that they would send in undercover officers to exchange to see if they could get more than one. And frequently, they would claim that we were distributing more than one-for-one, which I'm not really ever sure how they got that information. And so we would get pressure from our supervisor to be stricter with our policy, which in turn, of course, puts more people at risk for sharing and getting diseases and reusing syringes, which is still very harmful to your health. So currently, just a little bit of literature, and Robert, I know I sent you this, but for some basic, I think, support of syringe access, in general, the CDC, the Surgeon General, and the federal guidelines, all of these have written up suggestions for syringe access programs. These are all very well-established United States government agencies that are fairly reputable. And they suggest that for an accurate or for the best practice of a syringe program, you should provide a needle for every injection that a person needs to inject. So that would imply a syringe distribution, in my mind.
Because because you're going to need more than one needle between the times of, even just for one person, between the one needle distribution time and then another, right?
Absolutely. And so that is what the current language is. And that, I think, is a pretty compelling argument in itself.
But the Santa Cruz Police Department didn't like that idea, and were pressuring you not only to do a one-for-one plus, but to do one-for-one very strict, is what you're saying.
When I was employed at the Santa Cruz AIDS Project, yes. That was my experience.
Is that your understanding, too, yourself,
Yeah, when
Emily?
The program started, it was a one-for-one program. I think it's something like 83% of all needle exchanges in the country now are at least a one-for-one plus. Programs that are still strict one-for-one are in the extreme minority, because of all this research that has come out pointing to the fact that it is poor public health to limit them in that way. Now, I think it's a little bit counterintuitive for people who aren't deeply familiar with all the research and the ins and outs of harm reduction work, because the idea of a one-for-one is that a used syringe has value if you're required to bring it back to the program, meaning that the hope is that it will be less likely for people to unsafely
stumble across it later.
We'll drop it somewhere that it, anywhere other than a biohazard container, basically. But the problem is the reasons why people tend to do that, tend to drop them off, the fear people have of being arrested and the consequences of that, losing one's home, losing one's children, losing one's freedom, etc., tend to outweigh any immediate concern about anything else. So people, that is something that we've been hearing about consistently since the beginning of Needle Exchange. Because there are other reasons too why someone might not have one. We hear a lot of situations where, for example, one half of a couple might be controlling, shall we say, and if one half of the couple holds on to all the supplies, holds on to the drugs, and then they have an argument or are away from each other for a day or something, that other person still needs those supplies if they don't have access to their own personal used ones because their partner's holding on to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they come to us, and if we know them well and they say this, it presents us with an ethical dilemma of, do we adhere to the rules strictly and ignore what's in front of us and totally go against our whole mission of public health and encouraging responsible
injecting behaviors, you know, or do we
violate the supervisor's concerns because of Santa Cruz Police Department pressure and Steve Clark's private war against drugs?
Right. So, I mean,
Steve Clark is the deputy police chief, by the way, and I'm no fan of his, and I'm particularly no fan of his on this particular issue, as I understand it. But
This isn't particular to Santa Cruz at all.
It's a general police mentality.
No. The one for one issue is what I mean. People face the same sorts of situations everywhere, and because
the same political and police pressures as well. Because that's really what I'm interested
similar.
In here. I mean, it seems to me the facts are pretty clear in the literature, as you two describe it, you know, and even as seems to be accepted by critics, although I haven't, we probably should have in here a Take Back Santa Cruz or, I don't know, a drug warrior person who want a drug prohibition advocate who wants to, you know, give another side. And by the way, all of you listeners out there, if you do want to call in with questions, you can. We're talking with Emily Auger and with Penelope Jernberg, if you will, or Jernberg, if you're American, both with needle exchange at one time or another. Currently, Emily is struggling for, I guess, to have needle exchange survive. It has recently been banned in the city, it looks like, except on the outskirts where the MLN is.
No, it actually wasn't.
Not at all.
We thought that was what might happen.
Uh-huh. Oh, excellent.
And that's not what happened. So,
go ahead.
Because our site was closed at the Barson Street location, which is, I mean, honestly, it's not good the way that it happened. It created a lot of chaos for them to not approach us directly about closing the site. But we've certainly been through site closures in the past, and now we have a situation where all these different stakeholders have come together and agreed that we will work together to, you know, decide together on any new site. And
but right now there are no sites in the city, is that correct?
No, yeah, our substitute site is at Emmeline, but that clearly can't
remain. That's my point. They closed down all the sites in the city right now.
Yes, but the voting thing where they were actually going to ban it from happening, that did not happen.
No, but it is.
And it was made very clear that they will allow us to select sites
somewhere down the road. Somewhere down the road.
Right, but that is...
Not now, though. Not right now. Not tomorrow. Not the day after.
No, but that's an important point, because it means that we have that option that hasn't been closed off
to us. So all you needle users, just hang on for the next few months until they make a decision about what they're going to do. No, I'm sorry. Right. I really think right now it's an effective ban in the city as far as I can see, though not for the future. But right now it is a ban in the city.
Sure, right now. That's the situation.
What that means is, and I think it's had an impact, as I understand someone who testified.
60%.
Yes, but that was
me. Yeah,
you were the one who said that at city council. You said there's a 60% reduction in the number of needles exchanged, which indicates, now we can kill off all those addicts because they'll get more diseases and die more quickly. I guess that's the alleged hope of some people speaking at city council. I don't think that's the responsible hope of a number of people. And I was putting out misinformation myself, suggesting that HIV and hepatitis C is spread more easily through non-needle interactions, or it's a health hazard for folks, not just needle users, but also for the rest of the community. It is to some extent, but it's mainly a health hazard for people who are using needles, right? It's not for the people. You're not going to pick up HIV or hepatitis C, you know, by somebody coughing next to you who has it.
No, those are both bloodborne.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. And I don't think I fully understood this when I started talking about it, but still, more needles being, you know, dirty needles around means, it can mean more needle sticks, and that's something I wanted to ask. I'll ask you, Penelope, what you know about this, both in Reno, where you are currently working as a needle exchange worker?
I'm not currently working there. I'm currently trying to lobby for legislation to pass to decriminalize syringe possession, because there is no access to syringes without a prescription in Nevada. So they have alarmingly high rates of HIV and hepatitis C.
So you're not going to confess that you're out there secretly and illegally giving away needles?
Oh, no, I tried to. Nobody was into it, though.
Really? Interesting.
I personally don't have the connections to just cruise around town and hand out syringes. I don't have that kind of background in Reno, unfortunately, so I don't know the right people. but if I did, I certainly would have. But nobody was really on board with that because it's still illegal. So.
Another issue that came up for me, and that's what I wanted to ask you about, and you too, Emily, is needle sticks. That is to say, the folks getting stuck with needles and, you know, they're not necessarily getting infected, but having to worry about it, having to get medical treatment for it. One of the big fear draws in the last 3 months has been this image of little children playing in the playground, getting, you know, when they're bare feet, or, you know, running along the beach merrily when suddenly, wham, they get stuck with hepatitis C and HIV. How frequent is this in Santa Cruz? How many needle sticks have been reported in the last decade, as far as you know?
That would really be a question someone from the health department would have to answer, but as far as I understand, it's pretty low. And now, needle stick, is it... You know, there's a number of ways of looking at it. If you look at it scientifically, it's important to understand the difference between a needle stick in, say, a medical setting, you know, within moments after the needle has been in initial contact with infected blood, and, you know, very quickly poking, like a doctor or a nurse. Medical settings tend to have slightly higher rates of actual infection resulting from needle sticks because of that. When you're talking about...
Because of what? I'm sorry. Why would they have higher rates of infection?
Well, because they're...
Aside from the fact that hospitals are unhealthy places.
Some of them are. Yeah. Some of them are. Anyway, okay, to understand hepatitis C, it's talked about with HIV a lot, but they're actually really different. Hepatitis C lives outside the body much, 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 much longer than HIV. HIV, once it's exposed to the air, is pretty much useless as a virus. It's not going to do anything. The reason why syringes and needles are particularly dangerous are because the blood can stay in an air-free environment. You know, and, mm-hmm. but with hepatitis C, because it lives outside the body for so much longer, it can remain alive on the tip of a needle, on invisible blood particles on the outside. But again, the way that you have to get it is blood to blood. You can't get it by just having contact or breathing around it. You have to have a pathway into your bloodstream for that infected blood
kissing,
to reach you.
Perhaps?
You'd have to be chewing pretty hard while kissing.
Keep away from me, Emma.
Blood, 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 blood. It's bloodborne, bloodborne, bloodborne.
And the blood has to go into another blood surface.
Does this mean that it's medically more dangerous, more likely to get a needle stick infection than, let's say, gaily tripping through the playground when you find 1,000 needles that they found? You know, they come running into city council with, and I'm exaggerating for dramatic effect, of course, but... Why is it more dangerous?
They did have some fistfuls.
They had fistfuls of needles. But, you know, what I'm saying, though, is why is it more dangerous in a medical setting? Why is it more likely you're to be infected? Because it's... I was trying to... You were making a distinction between...
Right, with HIV or something. You know, to get infected from a needle... So if you think about a needle, it's a tiny little space with a, you know... maybe an inch at the longest in general space with a, you can have blood living inside of there. Then you've got the barrel and you've got a plunger.
Mm-hmm.
If it's been used properly and there's no air in there, if it's an airtight space, any infected blood that's in there, if it's got HIV in it, remains virulent. So if you get pricked with that needle and the plunger pushes and actually pushes that blood into your bloodstream, you can then become infected. Mm-hmm. In terms of HIV, most, you know, like I said...
And so you're more likely to have this plunger happen in a medical setting than, you say, on the playground or on the beach, or, you know, maybe if you're collecting needles and you prick yourself.
Yeah, that's just how the stats are. The other thing is, I mean, I think...
But you don't know the reason why that is.
I think
it's the time constraint, I believe, because the virus is more present as closely after that blood has been
in a medical
taken
setting.
Out of the body...
Okay.
And then the virus slowly degrades over time outside of the body.
So we don't have the stats for needle sticks in Santa Cruz, But, I mean, I heard of three instances of needle sticks in the last 5 years that were mentioned in the testimony. I think one of them was even mentioned by Councilmember Posner. One was mentioned by a person testifying. And I may have missed something, but I mean, do you two have any knowledge of, are we talking about hundreds, dozens, a handful of needle sticks? What's the dimension of that problem outside?
It's a handful. It's not a lot.
Mm. So what we're talking about is hysteria around needle sticks as a basis for shutting down and banning, I can use the word, needle exchange for now in the city of Santa Cruz, except at this distant site in Emmeline, where you're still being attacked for allegedly not having county health approval. Let's talk about that. And now you do have it, but you were getting this this grilling from Councilmember Right-Wing Robinson, as I call her, and her buddy Comstock, the new council member, that somehow you hadn't gotten the adequate, you hadn't put it through the right process at the county. County health has not approved
you.
No,
that's a misunderstanding. We've, since SOS became SOS, we have had county authorization. What that means is there's a memorandum of understanding where the county, the HSA, health department, recognizes SOS as a legitimate needle exchange program. Okay, the issue about us lacking state authorization, and this is another one of those things that is kind of counterintuitive. The only reason why that option exists is for programs that do not have their county's approval, either because it's an independent program that's running alongside a county-run program, and so they don't authorize or something, but state authorization of needle exchanges is not greater than a county-level authorization. And our authorization is not informal.
Well, I think
it is formal.
The claim that Robinson or Comstock or Cynthia Matthews, I'm not sure, maybe one of the three of them, was maybe it was Chereses. These are all council members who seem to be jumping on the hysteria bandwagon. We're all saying that, or one of them said that, you did not have authorization to open up a more frequent needle exchange at Emmeline Street to make up for the loss of the Barson Street site.
Okay, right. That's a slightly different issue. What the situation is, we have regular and friendly and positive collaborative contact with HSA. Okay, they are aware that we're doing
sites. HSA is the
Health Services Agency, Public Health Department.
Are you feeling left out there, Penelope? Are you with us still?
Oh, no.
Okay,
Emily knows a lot more than I do.
Okay. And if you want to jump in, just shout loudly because your voice is much more distant and far away than Emily's at this moment. But go ahead, Emily.
Okay.
We just haven't come to an agreement or a conclusion about how long we're going to be there. I mean, our hope is that we won't be there for very long. We would really like to find a better spot to be doing this that's much more accessible.
Well, once the task force meets in 6 months, I'm sure they'll come back with some very exciting suggestions.
Right.
Handpicked by, of course, that great liberal Mayor Bryant, who has already stated that illegal campsites, crime, and discarded needles are the boogeyman here in Santa Cruz. I think a dangerous statement to make that really impacts homeless and poor people outside, and particularly since all survival campsites in Santa Cruz City are illegal. It is illegal to sleep at night in Santa Cruz outside. After 11 o'clock at night, it's a crime. So
I think it's really important to understand the role that stigma plays in all of this. The rates for actually getting infected from a needle stick out in public somewhere, it's something like, less than 2%, like, of needle sticks resulting in infection. Okay, it's that the actual risk is really, really small.
2%
of the total number of needle sticks.
And the total number of needle sticks itself is very small.
Right.
Yeah.
But, like, the likelihood of
so it's only 2% of
resulting
of a very small
in an infection. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of that, though, in our culture, when people see needles outside of a medical setting, the association is dark and evil.
Yeah.
And there's an association of, stereotypes of people totally lacking morals, this idea of junkies, It's like a medically induced selfishness.
Addicting your daughters and sons.
Right. And
also needles themselves are, you know.
Well, everything associated with that is, because of drug war culture, you know, it's become this thing that it's totally fine to have stereotypes about these things. It's totally fine to hate junkies, and seeing a needle brings up all of these dark emotions for people.
And also junkies are, you know, doomed people who can't be helped anyway because they're just going to, you know, or alternately, we'll just send them to a non-existent drug program. It was the next thing.
And people do not like to get close to that. There's a fear of contagion around things like addiction, depression, homelessness, hopelessness, you know. People don't want to get close to that kind of thing for fear of it rubbing off on them.
Or for fear of, you know also, permanent. I'll get so depressed. I'll get addicted. Don't keep that thing away from me.
Because
I'm having such a bad time with, you know, trying to pay, half of my salary, you know, in rent. Another thing is needles themselves are not a pleasant phenomena for a lot of people to contemplate, even in medical settings. Who wants to be shot up and going to the dentist, the needle? I mean, it's...
Sure, and I mean, one of the things that's been upsetting for all of us at the Needle Exchange through this is that we recognize that improperly disposed syringes is a problem. You know, it's definitely a problem, and we would like to have more sites. We would like to have more staff and volunteers to serve injection drug users better. We would like to see public drop boxes come back up. We would like for pharmacies to be able to receive used syringes in biohazard containers.
Was there a change in that status where they previously... Were there public drop boxes before, and they were removed?
Yes.
When did they come in? When did they go out, and
they
why?
They came in, I think it was 2001, and I'm not sure when they left, but...
I think about 05.
05, okay. So as I understand it, and I wasn't actually... I was there when they were put up, and when they were first put up, I remember the first week they were there, we got a thank you note on one of the ones that was at the Civic Center from a member of a orchestra that had come from out of town to perform there. And a woman wrote, "I'm a diabetic. I'm so happy to see this in your town. You know, kudos to Santa Cruz. You're a wonderful city. Thank you for providing this. I really appreciate it as a diabetic." Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they're in every airport. They're in every casino.
Why were they removed?
They were removed because, as I understand it, due to funding cuts, there was no longer staff available to go and maintain them several times a week.
What's the cost of maintaining them? Does anybody know here? Penny, do you know?
It can't be that much just to go. The actual process itself can't take more than 15 minutes to empty a biohazard and pack it into another
how many,
one.
How many were there in Santa Cruz before they were removed?
Let me think. There are a few at the Civic Center. There are a few at Loudoun Nelson. The
Boardwalk.
There were three bathrooms at the Boardwalk or Wharf. The Metro bathrooms in both Watsonville and Santa Cruz. And am I missing some? I mean, there were a good number of them.
10 or 20, perhaps.
Yeah, it would have been nice to have more. More is better than... less in this case, because one might attract a lot of attention and negativity. But if they're kind of everywhere, like tampon machines, then people will just access them as they encounter them. And, you know, we can hopefully we'll be seeing those back up soon, because it has been sort of agreed that.
Agree with who?
In conversations with the city council and the neighborhood groups, it's been kind of agreed
down
that this needs
the road,
to be.
There's going to be some more of these Sharps containers.
Right.
Somewhere down the road. Meanwhile, we'll hire more cops, and then somewhere down the road, we'll put in some more of those containers.
Right.
And maybe bathrooms way down the road.
That's probably way down the road.
Way
bathrooms
down.
Are a lot more.
We don't want to jump too far on this.
Bathrooms are a lot more controversial than drugs.
Yeah, we don't need a bathroom. Yeah, you know, bathrooms are really a pretty visionary notion.
All polite people know that real... kind, decent humans don't use a bathroom.
They never see it in the movies. At least you never used to, right? You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. Name of the show is Bathroom Spears Brothers, and we are talking with, sometimes talking with Penelope Jernberg, and with Emily Auger of the Needle Exchange SOS, which again stands for
Street Outreach Supporters.
I get that one. Street Outreach Supporters.
May I add? I wanted to add quickly on just some statistics for improperly discarded syringes in communities. There's one such study that's become increasingly popular because at this point I believe it's the only one of its kind that compared two cities, one that had a functioning syringe access program and one that did not and had similar demographics as far as population and drug use goes. So in the city that did have a syringe access program, the number of improperly discarded syringes was, I believe, about 60% less than the city that did not have any services. So this idea that there's going to be more syringes in areas that have programs is pretty clearly dispelled with some of the research that's been done. The
name of the study is, for those people listening who want to check it out?
I don't have the name of the study off the top of my head, but I do know if you Google it, it's been in the last 5 years. It's between a study in a city in Florida, I think St. Lauderdale
and
San Francisco.
San Francisco
and
Miami.
I've got it in here somewhere.
If anybody wants to call in and speak to either of these women about this issue or me, I'm a wealth of knowledge in all this, of course. Yeah, they can call in at 427-3772, area code 831-427-3772. And, yeah, we have our phones are operational, so I will be keeping an eye on an ear on the board for you to call in. Another issue that critics raised from the right at the city council, which, again, had this really, I think, disgusting approach of acting like it was talking about an issue when behind the backs of the entire community, it closed down Needle Exchange through threatening the landlord of the property who had previously been allowing it there. Not that I'm no fan of this landlord particularly and how he treats his tenants necessarily. And I recognize, but I mean, what I was concerned about is not only was this done without any police stats showing an increase in crime or needle sticks or a reason to close it down in this area other than people ranting about crime generally, but there was also a process this was done. It was done behind closed doors. It was done, I think it was done a week before, was it not, before the council actually discussed this issue in public. When were you told to shut this down, or when did you get the word to get out of there?
Right. I mean, it was kind of, the part that was awkward was that we had actually, myself and another representative of our organization actually met with members, you know, people from the city, police, county, when we were talking about the fact that we would agree to work together in choosing any future sites. And at that point, when that meeting was happening, they had already
we
received a letter from the landlord the following day after that meeting. So during that meeting, they knew it had happened,
but
didn't tell us.
How long before that meeting was the city council meeting at which you spoke? Do you remember?
The city council meeting where they... The private one or the public one?
The public one.
Oh, I think it was like a week and a half, week.
So in essence, they had decided to close it down actually before the private closed city council meeting. Because the closed city council meeting was the Monday, I think it was a week before the open meeting, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't remember exactly the order of events, but I know that they're...
See, to me that's important because the community had no input into this at all.
Right. I'm not sure why they felt it necessary to have that be in a closed session, especially when they had actual contact with us. I mean, to me, that suggests that they were concerned that our reaction would be something other than what it was, which is, you know, we can handle criticism, we can handle community input, we can handle people telling us that they're frustrated with having us in their neighborhood. We also have people who tell us they're very glad that we were in their area. There are many more of those people than
Unfortunately,
you might realize
none of
not...
them came to city council and said that. Not a damn person, except maybe, I don't know, one or two. I think I spoke up on this issue.
No, when people are... articulately. I think, being angry is more of a motivator to do something like go to a city council meeting.
I want you in my neighborhood. I didn't hear anybody stand up and say, I'm glad you're there. Please stay there. Work regularly. I haven't seen an increase in crime. All of these things which seem to me to be pretty obviously true if what you're telling me, what the two of you are telling me is accurate. Instead, the city council is responding to hysteria and essentially right-wing ideology is what they're responding to, which is the sort of, tolerance of drugs. This means more tolerance of drugs. If you have more needles, you're tolerating drugs, which, of course, is the whole theory of harm reduction. Namely, you have no choice but to tolerate what is going on insofar as it's continuing to happen and has real health consequences. But I want to understand the order of this, and I think it's very important because it shows that the city council, I've always had the belief that the city council staff is a very strong right-wing element in it, that it's much more conservative even than conservatives on the city council itself, although it's hard to beat Robinson and Comstock for conservative ideology on this issue. But I think, they're conservative in the sense that they're really kind of elitist conservative. They will do stuff behind closed doors. They will do stuff on their own agenda. They put stuff into the city council agendas that gets rubber stamped through. Like this whole public safety committee report came from Scholl, Tina Scholl, I believe it was. No, it wasn't. It was Scott Cooper. Is that his name? The fellow who was the staff person for the public safety committee. It came through him. Not a word was changed. It went to city council, and it really wasn't much change there either. Although I think, first of all, Cynthia Matthews wanted to kind of exclude it from the city, and then she said, "Okay, we'll have it," because Elaine and Posner pushed it and said, yeah. When we discuss this, we won't exclude the possibility of it being in the city. But the fact of the matter is that the real decision, the only real action taken other than the let's chat some more about this, was shutting it down. They shut you down. And then they vilified you in front of the community and put you in the... And nobody stood up and said... You guys didn't either, and that was something, by the way, activist Steve Plaich was very upset about. He was very concerned that you guys didn't say, "What the fuck are you doing?" In the strongest words, you have to use the words "fuck" necessarily. But
didn't stand up in what situation?
Why are you closing us down? We're not creating a hellish atmosphere. There is no crime here. Why are you doing this behind closed doors? This is outrageous. That kind of outrage, I think, would have sparked and might spark, it's still in the present. A counter response to this, let's talk reasonably with these idiots. Idiots on this issue. I think I have a lot of regard for Annalisa Cube's organizing ability. I think she's a powerful person. I think she's fundamentally and toxically wrong on this issue. And I think she needs to be, the community needs to be told so. You're not going to tell her. It's not going to make any difference to her.
No, I mean, the last contact that I had with Take Back Santa Cruz is actually... quite positive. I wasn't joking when I said that.
No, I know they've
actually taken the time to really consider these issues and do some research of their own, and they were certainly willing to say that they wanted to continue communicating
with me. Sure, they had achieved their agenda, part of their agenda already, which is shutting you down. Although I think, frankly, that was done by frightened politicians and nervous city staffers who wanted to preempt outrage. And see, whether it comes from the left or the right in Santa Cruz, the city council does not want to be responsive to large community movements. That would require them to actually be a representative body instead of have their experts make all the decisions. See, that's my view on this.
Yeah, the whole thing is just very surreal. This has been... Needle exchange harm reduction has been around for quite a while now. There's almost more research on it than almost anything else in the public health world because it has been so contentious historically. And, right now, in our community, historically, our program was looked at as one of the more groundbreaking, strong programs. And we set the pace for a lot of things that are standard in needle exchanges across the country now. To suddenly to suddenly be experiencing this backsliding in terms of support is very strange, you know. And I think that if people are not resistant to facts, research, education, it's, you know,
I think they are resistant. So that's the
problem. I know.
I think these activist groups, Take Back Santa Cruz, the Clean Team. Did you want to say something, Penelope?
You know, I think Emily is very succinct in how she explains things. I think just going back to what she mentioned earlier, you know, so much of it comes from fear and stigma, as she had mentioned, is, I think, a really big motivator for why people act on their emotions, feelings towards this concept, and sometimes look the other way mm-hmm. in spite of evidence.
Yeah, and the only way to really deal with that is to get to know people and talk to them as much as possible, you know, to
Absolutely.
get to the heart of what's going on in somebody's heart and mind. I mean, a lot of people have folks who are close to them who have struggled with addiction, and it's a really sensitive issue for a lot of people. And often when somebody comes to me really angry about needle exchange, you're enabling people, a lot of the time there's a dead relative in the background or something. And the only way to break through this kind of thing is to really listen to people, give them the opportunity to spit out all the venom and hopefully allow them to continue to the point where they actually say what's most meaningful to them. When you get to that point, you know, mm-hmm. you find out what's at the core. I mean, unfortunately, this isn't what happens during, like, city council meetings.
Because I think it's a power trip that's going on here now. This is a group that wants to seize power. It has a number of things on its agenda. You know, needle exchange is the pricking edge of this stuff.
It's a distraction.
It's a hysterical point of focus that mobilizes people's fears and prejudices and enables them to gain traction, so much so that, you know, as I said, the visible aspect of what went down, this Public Safety Committee report, which was passed by the council task force, more money for the police, more priorities to destroy homeless survival camps, a brilliant approach to dealing with a homeless people situation, and I'm sure a very healthy one in terms of creating more healthful situations. But all this is, I mean, those are real things that they were able to, which Take Back Santa Cruz has been looking for a long time, mm-hmm. I think. But it's also mostly the discussion was about the task force report. Nobody said, well, very few said, we don't need more cops here. This is not an issue of police. It's an issue of priorities in terms yeah. of, you know, if you have police officers running around downtown, six cops showing up to stop a guy from sitting on the sidewalk, you know, or peacefully panhandling but a merchant doesn't like it, or a street performer who's 9 feet from a bench instead of 10 feet from a bench, and then says, I'm sorry, I'm not bothering anybody, leave me alone. Now that becomes a basis for, you're challenging this entire, it's unfortunate, I wish it were a house of cards. It's not. It's sort of this increasingly steel-girdered structure that mm-hmm. is very oppressive and very, very seriously intentioned and backed up by lethal force. You know? And so the question now arises, what can supporters of SOS and needle exchange, and also other, you know, rational solutions do to reverse this? I mean, you sound very mellow, and you say, you know, you've had some great conversations, and I believe you have. I'm not saying you're not telling me the truth to Take Back Santa Cruz. I mean, on a person-to-person basis, I'm always buddy-buddying with T.J. Magallanes and Ken Skindog Collins was right in line in front of me. We were talking. I interviewed both of them. And, you know, we agree on what seems to be a number of issues, and then they run up to the mic and start ranting about shut down the homeless lack of services center. I call it the homeless lack of services center because they don't provide shelter and they don't provide good process. But they do provide some things, mm-hmm. and to shut them down removes those things, which is wrong and mistaken. So I think you can have good individual contact with these folks, but is that the way to stop this right wing riptide, which is banned needle exchange in the city at the moment?
Yeah, no. People need to speak up if they're supportive of us. They need to come to those meetings. They need to write letters
but
to the sessionals.
But don't you need to throw meetings that organize this yourselves? I mean, don't you need to have to speak up? I mean, I know, and it's not an easy job, but there are people.
Yeah, you know,
you
we
need
actually,
to advocate for yourselves, or who will advocate for you? You know, that's the problem, isn't it? To some extent?
If that were the case, that would be the problem. That's not the case. We are organizing. We do have a lot of supporters. We have been having meetings. And if they're not necessarily public, it's because we're drawing in the experts to make a game plan for how we want to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
We just did this last weekend. I mean, we're not. I think that there's a mistaken impression out there that as a group of unpaid workers, there's something inherently amateurish or unprofessional about us, and that
it's more like you're under attack, and your response has been sort of to back off and to use a somewhat, oh, you know, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're working very hard, instead of saying, what the hell are you talking about? This has always been the case, you know.
if I may interject,
sure.
I think that is kind of inherently our purpose. That's kind of what drives, in general, all of us as volunteers and workers in this field particularly, is to have patience, to have compassion for another individual, whether they may be a user of drugs or whether they're not a user of drugs and don't support drugs. I mean, I think that compassion still needs to be there. And to have that dialogue, we need to have that relationship to build on and to understand their viewpoint before we can have that conversation and build further with it. To have a foundation of trust, I think, is what the Needle Exchange has been based on, is to have these relationships with people that at times maybe with our community that some people may not have those opportunities to have a trustful relationship. And whether those community members are our participants or they're the merchants that don't want us there, I think it's really important to our group and to the harm reduction method to have that basis of trust and to build on that understanding to then kind of work with them. Because we want to collaborate with people. I mean, we're obviously doing this for the health of the community, but I do strongly believe that we all want, you know, to be accepted and work with each other.
Part of the problem, really, and one of the things that is one of the reasons why we're not as outraged as I think you wish, is that there's so much misinformation. The vast majority of the criticism that's being leveled at us is based on things that are not true. You know, this idea of the 1-for-30 exchange that's been thrown out there a lot. If we were exchanging needles, someone brings one in, for every one we give out 30, I would be fairly critical of that. It seems like a kind of random multiplication. Why would you do that? So when people are questioning us and blaming us for needles on the beach, believing that that's how we run our program, I can understand why they think that, because that doesn't make sense. The fact is, that's not what we're doing. So, you know, it's more difficult to be outraged at a community, and I'm talking about the community, not politicians at this point. You know, I'm not outraged at people who have really rational responses to something, which unfortunately they've been given the wrong information.
Yeah, but the people who are driving this are not so much the community.
That's not who I was talking about.
Yes, but they're driving this. They're a part of the community that is driving this forward, including the staff, including the politicians, and including very active and very effective right-wing pressure groups. And the problem here is, and forgive me, everyone's going to, you know, I hate to use this metaphor, but when our Führer, Adolf Hitler, was coming to power, you know, there were those, and this is how he got into power, who said, this is a guy, you know, we have to talk reasonably to this guy. He's concerned about the German people. You know, we'll work with him. And they did. They tried to work with him. And when you're working with a hardline ideology, and that's what the drug prohibition ideology is, Nazis are people, too. They are. They got kids, they got dogs, they care about their relatives, they may even, and they're sweet people to talk to even. I imagine, I don't have too many Nazi friends these days, but, you know, or at least none who call themselves that. But the fact is, they have also a political agenda, which is very strong, which is not truth dependent. And if you're going to mobilize the people on the other side, you need, I mean, there are some people you don't need to be compassionate to and nice to in order to get them to say, this is outrageous. Let's, in other words, I think if you had that contingent coming to city council in the same numbers, or at least with some of the passion that this other group has put together, other groups have put together, you would have had a much different result. They would have at least been reluctant to shut it. I mean, I'd like to see somebody opening up an illegal needle exchange immediately in downtown Santa Cruz. In fact, I talked to a couple of church members in different places, and they said, we think it should be done.
But tell them to call us. Maybe we can have a site at their church. That's something we talked about. We need sites.
Calvary,
people want to get involved.
Calvary
people
Episcopal.
Want to really
to
get involved and be helpful. Allow us to host a site on your property.
Yeah.
If you're willing to do that, see, I've gotten the impression that you want to work it all out with the county authorities and get compassionate with these people who want to shut you down entirely.
Oh, no. Yeah. See, I didn't realize that you had these thoughts about me, my friend. You don't know me very well.
Okay, clue me in. She's going to wise me up here.
No, I'm not, because there's no...
Why not?
Because there's no purpose to that. Mm-hmm. I'm all about purpose right now. I can't waste time, you know.
The real
we
you
need,
is beginning to come
need,
out here.
I'm always real. This,
of course.
To achieve a site, to get a site going, we need permission of a property owner.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the first step.
Mm-hmm.
If people want us to do needle exchange in the city, if they really want to be supportive, contact us and say, hey, you
give
can do a site
number.
On my
people
property.
People can call for if property owner wants to
431-7138.
431-7138. So if anyone out there is a property owner or a friend of a property owner who wants to essentially take on Take Back Santa Cruz, the clean team...
Think of it that way. Just think of it as contributing to, you know, a flourishing needle exchange program.
Of course.
We need a site.
But it's also... we're talking about the political realities of this. See, that's the
political
point.
Reality is not nearly as important as the life and death issues of needle exchange. We have to have sites. None of us are involved in this stuff because of the politics. That stuff doesn't really interest me. I don't really care about that. The life and
death
issues.
You want to be arrested downtown as a needle exchange worker?
Sorry?
Are you willing to be arrested downtown?
I was.
Again, are you willing to be arrested in 2013?
Yes.
Now, this year?
I wouldn't be doing this otherwise.
What I'm saying is, for the same reason that Food Not Bombs activists have to face that decision when they're told to leave the property or leave the public space, they have to make a decision whether they're going to say no. You know, it's more important that people get food. And you're saying, no, it's more important that people have health care and so forth. But it's something, I think, also that, well, maybe it's just
no,
my personal...
No, that's not what I said, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. What are you saying?
I think you're trying to put things in a box a little bit. I'm just trying to point out the purpose of needle exchange, which has been proven and proven and proven and proven and proven and proven, and which nobody at city council is actually arguing with. Everyone is...
They're arguing for a strict one-for-one. I'm sorry. They are arguing.
They're not arguing against needle exchange as a concept, as a useful entity in a community.
They're arguing against, in favor of strict one-for-one, which I think...
Yes, they are.
It defeats the fundamental purpose of needle exchange, which is to provide clean needles when they're needed. Let's not, you know,
I don't know why you're,
you know.
I don't know why you're arguing with me. This is something that I'm...
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I need to understand this.
Okay, well, Penelope, do you understand what's going on here? Are you...
I'm not sure why you think... I don't think that you should be mistaking my calm demeanor or willingness to work with people for, like, an absence of understanding of the politics. My point is that all that stuff is far less important than the work that we do. And people need to remember that. Politics stuff, It ebbs and flows.
The work that you do
I've
has been stopped in the central core of the city, correct?
Correct. And we're still reaching people. I'm still exchanging with people every day.
Good for you.
Okay? You know, like this idea that we've been shut down, yes, but it's still happening. We're still finding
but
ways to do our work because we have to.
Right,
That's what people need to understand.
But it's a much smaller scale than you were doing before, yeah?
Uh-huh. We're having to be a lot more creative about encouraging people to use our delivery services and things like this. It's frustrating, but it's, you know, we've been through this kind of thing before. The politics are going to come and go. You know, HIV, hepatitis, overdose, the stigma against drug users, that remains consistent. People aren't going to care about this after a while, you know? It's like this, the human element needs to be remembered. It's more important than the politics.
Well, I think the human element underlies it all. Penelope, you wanted to say something?
Oh, no, I was just in agreement.
Yeah. I mean, the human element obviously is the core of what moves you in this situation. The issue to me, though, is the practical reality is that there is a significant reduction in needle exchange because of the political actions taken by a group of Neanderthals at the city council, or people acting in a Neanderthal manner, I believe, responding to hysteria and fear.
Mm-hmm.
And is an appropriate response to this to, that's why you saw me get a little ticked, and there may be the conflict between us here, to simply say, well, you know, we have to, you know, appeal to these people's sense of understanding and give them, if only they have the facts and we're compassionate with them, they'll come up with the right solutions. Now,
that's not what I said.
Okay.
I said that the most effective way of actually battling stigma and the issues around it is to have one-on-one conversations. And I said that's not what happens in politics. That's not what you get at a city council meeting. That's the problem, right? We don't have that level of conversation, you know. It doesn't happen in those situations, which is too bad, you know.
But the city council is impacted by the pressures that are put upon it from the other side as well as from the Yahoo side.
Certainly. I think it's important to point out, though, that, you know, there's fewer than 10 of us. Okay, there's, you know, maybe 5 or 6 of us who are basically doing the bulk of this work right now.
Uh-huh.
And our focus is on seeing our participants every single day.
Yeah,
you know?
I understand.
And that keeps us pretty busy because this isn't a full-time job for any of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have lives, and if we haven't managed to mobilize a giant political movement on top of managing,
you failed
the dealing
again
with stuff. Yeah, I'm sure I have, but you know,
yes,
succeeding as well on the things that are not visible to the public and absolutely should not be visible. You know, these are private issues. Okay, you know, if we need to rise up, give us a call. You know?
And again, the number to call if you have a site or if you want to be of assistance or if you want to put a full-page ad in the paper, 431-7138 is the number to call. It's a 24-hour number? Or
yeah, it's a cell phone. Leave a message, send a text.
Uh-huh. You are tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM. It's also freakradio.org. And I'm in the studio with Emily Auger, and on the phone, hanging in there, is Penelope Yernberg, both of whom have been with Needle Exchange on and off for the last decade at least, if not longer. You've been here for, what, a couple decades yourself,
mm-hmm.
Emily. Steve Fleisch wanted me to bring up the issue for you of trying to, you know, get through the Byzantine mind of David Tarasis and the other city council members. I think it's quite appropriate, by the way, not to be compassionate to these people at all. They're politicians, and they're dangerous, and they're stupid on these issues, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't feel it's, you know, I don't feel it does anybody any good to misrepresent
Maybe you
this.
Know them better than I do.
I don't know them well at all, except I just from what they do. I mean, and what they say and how they respond. And also, you know, I've attempted to communicate with them in a gentle and peaceful way and so forth. But safe practices, best, what is it called, best practices?
Mm-hmm.
What's the proper terminology I'm looking for?
Best practices.
This apparently is something that some city council members feel is important. And best practices mm-hmm. has, as you were pointing out at the beginning of this show, and I think you too, Penelope, has to do with one for one plus, which for those who just tuned in is needle exchange, where you give, you know, you take in the needles you get, and then you also give as many as they need at that time. You're starting with the basic model of one for one, but you're also willing to recognize that there are times where people need more needles, and there are also times where not everybody can come, you know. And so, anyway, is this best practices approach. He's suggesting this is one way to appeal to the council and other activists.
Well, they're the ones who set this particular agenda item. They are the ones who told us we want a model needle exchange program in our community that adheres to best practices.
Uh-huh.
Now, fortunately, these things exist, and we know about them because we base our policies on best practices and harm reduction.
One for one plus?
Well, let me put it this way. There, a couple years ago, a group of the most expert researchers, professional researchers who focus on needle exchange harm reduction.
I'm not your expert. I run for my gun. But that's another story. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of really smart people who have done a lot of really strong research on
people
needle exchange came together.
Whose opinions and research you respect, that's what would be more interesting to me.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Came together, and what they did was they made this thing, which I have here, recommended best practices for effective syringe exchange programs in the United States, the results of a consensus meeting mm-hmm. of all these experts. And to put it pretty plainly, they've got, at the beginning, little summary here. They have a list of the characteristics of effective syringe exchange programs and a list of syringe exchange program practices to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the list of characteristics for an effective syringe exchange program.
Mm-hmm.
It says ensure low threshold access to services, which means maximize access by number of locations and available hours.
Mm-hmm.
Ensure anonymity of participants.
But did you get the permission of the county before you extended your hours out there at the county? And have you been keeping records? We need to know this.
Yes, on both. We keep records of everything, and County was certainly aware that we were there.
Trying to mock some of our more distinguished city council members.
And I'm just telling you the answers to the questions that they apparently couldn't handle listening to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so next. Promote secondary syringe distribution. Train and support peer educators.
Secondary syringe distribution would be...
That means, every time someone comes to exchange, we ask them the question, how many people are you exchanging for? If someone comes with four syringes and it's just for one person, that's one situation. Someone comes with four syringes and it's actually for six people,
how do you
that's
deal
a different
with these
situation.
Two situations differently? What would be the difference you would use? How would you address these differently?
I would continue the needs assessment process that we have with everybody when they come in, which is just a conversation where we ask questions about, you know, how many rigs does it take to get one shot in? How many shots do you do a day? How often are you able to come to the exchange? From that information, you can arrive at a number. How many needles do you need?
Mm-hmm.
And how many people... You know, whatever.
Have you done any video work on this, by the way? Have you done videos where you actually, you probably have training videos for people who are getting into needle exchange for your volunteers?
Not
in the halcyon days when you were funded better?
There's videos out there. There's tons of videos out there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, other aspects, other characteristics. Maximize responsiveness to characteristics of the local IDU population. Provide or coordinate the provision of health and social services. Include diverse community stakeholders in creating a social and legal environment supportive of syringe exchange programs. Okay. Practices to avoid supplying single-use syringes, which early on was brought up.
That's still one of the demands that I guess Annalisa Cube has. Is there single-use syringes?
Let's hope not, because those things do not work.
I think so.
Limiting frequency of visits and number of syringes. requiring
one-for-one
exchange, imposing geographic limits,
not in the
restricting
city.
Syringe volume with unnecessary maximums, requiring identifying documents, and requiring unnecessary data collection. So pretty much most of the things that we've received criticism about or the suggestions that were made, actually, when you look at what's understood in the harm reduction professional community to be the actual best practices.
These are a bunch of intellectual pinheads. We don't care what they say. We care about common sense. We don't want needles in our neighborhood. And see, that's what you're going to keep getting. See, that's my fear. And the compassion and the expert testimony, it's going to be, you know, keep them out of our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Not my backyard. And the question is, how do you counter that? I disagree with you. I don't think it is. I think on a one-for-one basis, yes, when you're talking to people. But in terms of the political punch that's needed to stop that, which I understand, you got another job to do. Needle exchange is a job you got to do.
Right.
But somebody has to do that job, and it has to come out of, and I don't know where it comes from. You know, I mean, I, you know, I'm an idiot on needle exchange, and I just have some ideas that I express, and I'm doing this through this discussion with you. CVS, I understand, on the west side now no longer will supply syringes unless you provide documentation. Have you heard that? That's what I heard from one of our callers who called in last week and said that.
Documentation, you mean a prescription?
Yes.
It's totally up to the pharmacist's discretion whether they want to sell syringes or not. They can make a blanket.
What are the practices
policy
in Santa Cruz for the major, for the pharmacies?
There's a number of pharmacies that participate in the program, which means that they will sell syringes to people without a prescription. Most of them don't take used syringes back in biohazard containers, which is unfortunate.
Could
meaning
that be made
we're
mandatory
the only ones
at a city level?
Sorry?
Could that be made mandatory at a city level?
Oh, I don't know that the city can tell pharmacies that they have to do that, but I think that what would be helpful would be for maybe Take Back Santa Cruz to use their energy to find out from the pharmacies what would it take to make them feel comfortable accepting full bios of used syringes from people.
And in your compassionate hug sessions with Take Back Santa Cruz, have they indicated any inclination to be interested in this?
We haven't had a chance to get into the details of that, but I think that, I mean, the reason I said that is because that was something that they were critical about when they went around to the pharmacies to check, you know, how things were running.
Mm-hmm.
They were rather upset that they had trouble turning in a biohazard with used syringes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I think that the point is kind of, that's right. The needle exchange is pretty much the only place where you can do this easily, turn in used syringes. So by limiting us,
until it was banned in the city 2 weeks ago. Let me ask you this also. Was needle exchange, did you voluntarily shut down the Barson site before the city council meeting, before the closed city council meeting? Because another person I talked to said she found in January it was increasingly hard to find you folks there at the Barson site. Were you doing it in January?
Yes.
You were. And the same time, 7 to 9?
Yes.
Was it three days a week?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just checking. You know, I mean, I'm not, she may have, you know, gone at the wrong time or who knows what she was doing. Penelope, you, in your letter, you talk to some extent about problems with the police department and specifically with my old friend, Deputy Chief Steve Clark, who is frequently quoted in the newspapers, more so than Kevin Vogel, who seems to have surrendered his scene to Steve. I don't like Steve, but I mean, that's not the issue. The issue is, you know, what actually the police department in Santa Cruz, how its position has been on needle exchange, how it's impacted needle exchange, and your own personal experiences with it. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know you wrote about it in this letter, but can you talk to us about that? And then after that, maybe Emily, you can tell us some of your sense of how things are going. And be as candid as possible and destroy your relationship with the police department if possible, too. That's part of my major objective here.
Well, and again, I do want to clarify before I say anything that anything I say is only on my behalf. I don't want to ever get SOS in trouble for anything. I'm unfortunately no longer able to volunteer with them. I was at one time very involved, and I did have several conversations with police officers as a volunteer of SOS. And so my specific interaction with Steve Clark was, as I had referred to, when we were trying to establish ourselves, and we were really excited to be able to have more freedom because we, as the volunteers, were the people running the show. So that was something that we hadn't had the opportunity to do with the Santa Cruz AIDS Project. So, you know, we were taking our liberties of establishing our policies and figuring out best practice, like Emily was referring to. And so what we always wanted to do was to establish a relationship with the police department. I mean, during my time there, I was really looking forward to having police support. I don't think that it is this completely outlandish idea. I've talked to at least one or two police officers that are in support of needle exchange, and there are some understanding individuals on the force, and I think I really wanted to try and work with them and have a training session with them during their roll call, go in there and just chat with them and have a conversation, have an open dialogue, and say, hey, this is what we do, this is who we are, we're interested in your input, these are the laws, this is why we're doing it under these laws, it is a legal program, these are the laws that our participants are working with, trying to work with them and help them out as well as hearing their feedback. So in order to do that, I had to call the individual who is in charge of having roll call visitors. And I forget how I got his contact information. He was a person somewhere else in the force. So I spoke to this gentleman a couple of times, and he was really receptive. He was super supportive. He just said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. We'd love to have you in here. And I told him who I was, and that I was working with this syringe exchange, and this is, you know, what I wanted to do. And he's like, oh, that would be great. We've been wanting to talk to you guys, blah, blah, blah. I said, oh, great. Give me a call back when we can set up a time. So I didn't hear from him for weeks, so I finally called him back, and he was like, I talked to my supervisor, Steve Clark. He said I can't talk to you anymore, but he said that you should, if you have any questions, you should call him. So, of course, I had questions. So I called him and, again, explained my situation and what I wanted to do, what I thought would be great, is just to get involved with the department. And, again, just wanting to have a dialogue, have a relationship with them, nothing in any way hostile that I can imagine. I think that there could be a really good relationship between the needle exchange and the police department. I mean, we're both trying to help people. That's ultimately the goal. Well, he was not receptive at all, and that conversation spiraled downhill pretty quickly. And that was, I believe, three plus years ago now. Oh, no, I guess 4 years ago. Sorry, I can't.
When you say he was not receptive, what form did this lack of receptiveness take?
He was pretty hostile. He was outright rude. He cut me off. He claimed that we didn't follow federal guidelines, which I, of course, tried to explain to him what they were. As I think I gave you the information on that, Robert, that there's very, very loose at best federal guidelines that we were obviously following because there's not much of them. But he didn't really care about that at all.
Did he specify what his concerns were with needle exchange in particular in any way?
He didn't actually specify that himself. He just said we were an illegal operation. He would never support us. He didn't support us. We were increasing drug use in his community, and he didn't want to work with us. And he said he would never support us. That was the last and only conversation I've had with him.
Well, I suppose.
And that was.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I mean, that was the extent of trying to reach out to the police department, in my experience.
So, in essence, Clark vetoed any interaction between you and trying to set up an orientation program. And I see
in a compassionate manner. Emily is nodding somewhat ruefully, but with a smile on her face. Emily, has that been the case in the last 3 years as well, or has there been a sea change? I mean, Steve Clark was at the city council meeting giving advice to the city council and to the community. Steve undergone a conversion of some kind?
I don't know, Steve. I haven't had...
Or the police department, you know.
Police department, different from Steve Clark. I haven't had the chance to speak to Steve Clark face-to-face or over the phone or anything else. I have had the opportunity to speak with Chief Vogel and with the other deputy chief, Rick Martinez, mm-hmm. And with both of those officers, I feel like we've had some very intelligent, thoughtful, productive conversations regarding our relationship and these issues that we're currently facing. As you mentioned, Steve Clark does seem to be the official spokesperson for the police department.
Spokesperson, really.
Most of the media situations, because I'm the spokesperson right now for SOS, a lot of the journalists who have interviewed me have first interviewed him, so I hear
secondhand
what he's been saying. And
Steve hasn't called you to chat with you, though.
No, I kind of wish that he would.
Well, perhaps you can call him. And
I don't have his number.
You can always give Penelope as a reference.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I think that as an organization, we've made it pretty clear to the police department that we are interested in having, you know, a functioning line of communication and a useful sort of relationship with one another.
Does such a line exist in your view at the present time?
That line is being worked out. I mean, one of the things that I think is important to point out is with the loss of the drop-in center.
Which was back in 2009?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because we have no headquarters, we have no office, we have no drop-in center. When we have meetings, we're meeting at each other's houses or something, you know. Because we've sort of lost our public face, mm-hmm. and because our work has been in some ways whittled down to the most essential services, which is syringe exchange and, you know, direct service for injection drug users. When we had more going on, when we had a building, we had more active collaborations with other service organizations in the community and just had more interaction with the broader community in general. And because we're sort of down to just doing our few sites a week.
You can be stamped out like small, vulnerable creatures.
Well, that's not how I was going to finish my sentence, actually. But
my fear.
Sure, and I can understand that fear. But, I mean, you know, I think that we haven't had much occasion to be focused on that as much as on maintaining the essentials,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
So we haven't been hiding from the police. We haven't been avoiding the police. We haven't been
reaching out to the police.
And we also haven't been reaching out to them. That's changed now. And we have had several, you know, in some of these community meetings, not the big open city council meetings, but on some of the smaller ones.
Is the public invited to SOS meetings, by the way, or are they private?
They're private.
And just off the...
If people have any questions, any concerns, any advice, if someone wants to yell at me...
Yell at you?
Yes, yeah. I can take it. We're very interested in hearing all of that. We definitely discourage people from coming to our sites unless they are a participant.
Mm-hmm.
The sites are expressly for our participants.
Is there less
so
police harassment? I mean, I guess the only thing we can talk about are the sites at Emmeline right now, because that's the only place you are. Or I guess you can also deliver. You're also mm-hmm. delivering. Mm-hmm. Are you delivering in the core of the city?
I will not tell you where any of our participants live.
Darn. I was hoping we could,
spread throughout the county.
We could stop you drug users before and stop that drug tolerance of spreading all over Santa Cruz. you know, what about police harassment in the last 4 years and even in the last 4 months? Has there been a change, an increase? Is there such a thing? I know that was a concern that I think you had, Penelope, when we talked 3 or 4 years ago about this issue.
My concern, I always had it because I think it's pretty relevant. And I haven't been involved very recently, but I know that was kind of a constant issue, is that a lot of times participants would get cited for things that weren't necessarily illegal, like maybe possession of 2 or 3 syringes that were unused when you're allowed to have up to 30. Things like that I really found were harassment, that people would be recognized as maybe having a pass or kind of targeted as a drug user, and they would get questioned and asked to search their belongings and kind of forced to do things. One such occasion that's just an anecdote, but I've heard of more than one person feeling that they deserved it in this sense because of the sad things that the police had decided to say to them, you know, that they deserved getting punched or getting their stuff taken from them because they were a user. Mm-hmm. And that kind of related into the police harassment. That was always a concern of mine.
Has that been increasing? I guess I have to ask, because you're not around right now, but I have to ask, Emily, is that, first of all, is that increased or decreased, or do you agree that it was there at all? And then secondly, have you complained to the police department about these issues and gotten any productive response if there were such concerns?
Of course those concerns are consistent. And, you know, that was one of our original hopes when Penny tried to reach out to them when SOS had first formed. The idea was we wanted to check in with them, let them know the changes that had happened within the program, let them know where we were operating, what our mission was, you know, who we were as individuals. And, you know, we wanted to open the line of communication so that if there were problems, you know, if we heard about harassment or something from one of our participants, we could write down the details and actually have someone who we could bring it to, you know, a community liaison of sorts.
Mm-hmm. It didn't go anywhere, though, or at least with Penny.
That's the conversation that
Penny had. But has there been anything subsequent to Penny? Because she wasn't around for the last few years. Have you or anyone else attempted?
Nope, that's what we're attempting to do now. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of good reasons for us to have a decent relationship with the police. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's always going to be individuals whose feelings or views about needle exchange or harm reduction are probably always going to mean that they're not going to respond well to anything connected to us. But it's also true that there's always going to be some officers who do understand it, who are supportive of it. And
see, my reaction to this has been, you know, police. I heard Martinez's, you know, compassionate statements about people getting their medicine, and we need people in drug programs and all this, mm-hmm. you know, what I regard as pitter-patter rhetoric, because it's all about programs that don't exist or that have long waiting lists.
Well, I think that's kind of what he said was, you know, treatment is what people need, and it's not
but
there.
But he also simultaneously is talking about increasing funding for the police department. You can't have it both ways. See, that's the problem. They want to increase funding for the police department. If they really wanted the treatment, they'd say, put the money in the damn treatment program.
That was our question.
So it's hypocritical horseshit, as far as I'm concerned. And it's, you know, it's PR coverage. And I don't like it because people already have an exaggerated sense of respect and regard for people in uniform with shiny buttons and badges and big guns. And I think that's a dangerous thing in this community because it provides the illusion of security without the substance, as we can see from recent events in the last 3 weeks. You know, it's a difficult community. It requires a community to be concerned about security, not just cops, and not just vigilante groups cooperating with the police agenda, whatever the fuck that happens to be, in this case, drug war shit, mm-hmm. and anti-homeless shit, and anti-needle exchange shit. I didn't see him saying, you know, there's no increase in crime in the neighborhoods around needle exchange during the time. He could have said that.
That would have had an impact on city council. He didn't. I went to him individually on the street, and I said, I'd like to know the stats in that area. He said, oh, that would be too difficult to find out. We'd have to look through reports. You know, instead, why not just suck off the, you know, the trough and get more cops in there and also create at the same time. See, I see this as creating more illness, creating more anxiety, and more needles everywhere all over the place, which, of course, is a self-perpetuating cycle because it leads to more power for those groups that can rant about it
mm-hmm.
and have people who are regularly concerned. You wanted to say something, Penelope?
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. I thought I heard some rumblings at your end, but perhaps not. How many needles have been exchanged in the last year by needle exchange? You have those stats. Plates, you said, used to keep them. What's
yeah,
the? They're open. They're public stats. Can the public go to a certain place and see how many were exchanged at each site each time? Is that open record?
We don't have. Our weekly stats up in a public place. We are accountable to our funders, and we prepare reports regularly.
Are they available for the community to look at if we want to?
If somebody called and asked, sure.
Okay.
We do have those
so
numbers.
If you want to find out the actual stats, call 431-7138,
mm-hmm.
and you at some point could have those available.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this kind of transparency is very important, just like I want Martinez's police reports on if there is more crime in the area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we need to give, you know, Annalisa Cube and the people in the, you know, the South of Laurel neighborhood, not the benefit of the doubt, no, but at least the benefit of facts about what's going on there.
Right.
But see, you didn't hear
facts,
you see. And I don't think, you know, I don't think these people are interested in facts, partially because the council likes to play with this shit. They don't really respond to the community's responses. They will put it into a study group or throw it into a task force
mm-hmm.
or talk about it in a committee somewhere down the road. And then, of course, they'll take action in a closed session at city council without any announcements.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not saying this is always done, but it's too frequently decisions are made out of public view and not transparent. And so
mm-hmm.
people are naturally pissed. They don't want, you know, and they get this stuff from Dr. Lubell, who made some rather... Well, we should probably go into some of the other stats that were presented at the city council meeting that seemed to indicate the authorities were fumbling and bumbling. One of the issues is records. And there's this big thing about, oh, you guys aren't keeping adequate records, you're not following state law.
Okay, all right,
so
here we go. The question of the records that was coming up. Needle Exchange keeps extremely good records. As I said, we write it down. We write down detailed accounts of every single exchange that we do. Okay?
Open to the public? If they want.
Well, it's not already, but if somebody wants, you know, a copy of our quarterly report or something, if they're interested in those numbers,
okay.
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, we don't try to keep those things quiet, but we haven't made an effort to...
I'm making a request right now, maybe in the next couple of weeks, if you can give me an account of that, I'd like to see it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, my thoughts just went in like six different directions.
All right, the question was the demand by the county that you... claim that you're not adequately keeping records.
No, the... Yeah,
you haven't issued an annual
county
report
hasn't,
or some bullshit.
No. The county... All right. The question is, in our agreement, the county said that they would present annual reports to the county board of supervisors.
Mm-hmm.
The county public health department has not done this. It's not on us to write their reports. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think that it's not an issue of...
What are the value of such reports, by the way? I mean, you know,
to get a realistic sense of what's going on with our numbers, to get a sense of, you know, issues facing injection drug users. How many are in the county that are using our services? How many needles are passing through us?
Did
it
they
tells
ever
you
issue
you know?
Such a report ever? Did they ever issue a report in the history of needle exchange?
County?
Yes.
I'm not totally sure. I think they probably have, actually. I know they've issued or they've prepared statements and papers and things on exchange.
And this is Lou Bell's responsibility, or was, while he was the head of the county?
I'm not sure who in particular was responsible for writing the report, but...
Penelope,
the point,
do you know?
I want to say that it's a part of the HIV yearly... I think it's a yearly, maybe biannually assessment. I know that they... come out with a needs assessment for the county with statistics, I believe, every year or 2 years, and I think the syringe access is included in there.
Right. But I mean, it's not on us. That's on them, and it doesn't say anything about a lack of relationship between the needle exchange and the county, because in fact we have a really good one and a strong one. You know, making it more having more formalized details to it is sort of what that's what the pressure is right now. Is they want us to have more contact, more formal reports, more formal interactions at regular intervals.
How will needle exchange be changed given this current the shutdown in the city at the moment and the attacks on needle exchanges as having to be more carefully supervised by the county? What kind of supervision will this involve, at least, and will that be a good thing?
I don't think it needs to be a bad thing. I mean, the people we work with in the county, we consider them our allies. All right, and we don't keep secrets from them. I don't think having more involvement with one another is going to result in anything negative.
They try to give you a strict one-to-one policy until you can only give out
one
needle.
Well, that would be real strange,
or have
because
one-use syringes. Or...
Well, no, as a public health department, they are far more
sensitive to the best standards.
Yes, to the facts and realities of and the health consequences. I mean, it would be I would be surprised if they supported a change for strict one-to-one.
Are you familiar with, I mean, I don't know about the situation in other cities. I know Canada and Ottawa, they attempted to, as I posted online, to restrict, first of all, to ban needle exchange and to restrict it to one-to-one, and then they gave up because they got the reports that this was a bad way to go. And but I'm wondering, has there been, that kind of know-nothing activity and consequence in some communities? Has there been a shutdown of needle exchange in different places because of this kind of pressure?
Yeah, I think in Connecticut in the early 90s, I believe there was a situation where, it's kind of similar to this, where there were improperly, unsafely disposed syringes found in public places. The needle exchange was blamed and subsequently closed, and then the problem became a lot worse. All of a sudden, an infection rate started to go up, so they put the program back in place. And everything got better,
There hasn't been a place where needle exchange has been permanently removed as a consequence of these apprehensions.
Oh, not that I'm aware of. See, the thing is, our history, when I say our, I mean the harm reduction movements in general, the roots of this, most of these programs started out as illegal programs. You know, when we first started doing it in Santa Cruz, there was no research backing up anything that we were doing. It was just people wanted to respond to the AIDS epidemic. This seemed like a good way to go about it. It turned out to be correct, but
1989.
Yeah, 87, 88.
So it was illegal actually before it became... It was established legally in 89, or...
No. What do you mean?
Well, in other words, when did you move from being illegal to being legal, a needle exchange?
Let's see. When we got the first declaration of a public health emergency by the Board of Supervisors, I think that was in 95?
I think that sounds right. I hate to interject, but I have to leave, unfortunately.
Hey, so do we. We're reaching the end of our 2 hours. Thank you for hanging on the phone for so long, Penelope. If people want to read what you have to write, have written me, which I think is very interesting, we've only touched some of these issues, please go to Santa Cruz Indie Media and look up the story, The End of an Era by Steve Plaich, and go to the comments section. Thank you very much, Penelope Jenberg, for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Emily. It was great to hear from you, and I'll talk to you both soon.
I'll give your regards to Steve Clark when I talk to him.
Yes, you too.
All right. Thank you. And I see we got a flood of calls to end this for the show, but I still think it was a worth going through this stuff, and I appreciate your coming, you know, to deal with this. Is there anything you'd like to kind of conclude with? Any thoughts, suggestions, any meetings coming up where you're going to rally the troops? I know you're busy exchanging needles, but you also need to make sure that the program doesn't get swept under the rug. And I guess you have some... You may have some confidence that's not happening, and maybe, you know, you're thinking I'm being too alarmist in my sense of this. I'm very alarmed at this whole attack on needle exchange.
It is alarming, but it's also unhealthy for me to react to everything that's alarming. If I did, I would be a basket case.
Sure. Well.
Well, I guess, you know, I would like to remind people that our program is not, in fact, a times 30 program. It's a one-for-one with an option of plus up to 30 based on a individual
needs
assessment.
What if somebody needs 35? Then what?
Well, you know, we'll tell them the next time they can come to exchange. Give them a schedule with the pharmacy locations where they can purchase them. You know, it's funny that no one is angry at the pharmacies for selling syringes without a prescription. That hasn't come up once. No one seems bothered by that at all. And I'm glad. I think that they should. But
well, pharmacies are, you know, they're always
very
useful.
They're angry at us for exchanging and for taking in the dirty ones. And,
well, you're part of the drug tolerance group that's helping to kill all our children and making them smoke pot.
Right.
Know, so.
Which is why we, our program does a lot. Our program does a lot of good, and the drug users in our community are doing a lot to take care of themselves and each other. You know, in
spite of great
personal
risk. Has there been an explosion of drug use in the last 2 or 3 years in your experience?
From what I've seen in this town, drug use tends to sort of ebb and flow, and there are periods of time when you see more or less heroin use. Right now, there's more speed use than there was a few years ago, but again, it ebbs and flows. It ebbs and flows.
So no big crisis has arisen, because that's the impression given by the mobs coming to city council.
The impression that I have is that a lot of people were not previously living, camping near the ocean in the numbers that they are now. And so now that they are there, after being removed from other areas, the waste that was previously somewhere else is now in a more high-profile area.
Interesting. That's something I've been.
I'm sure you'd never imagine anything like that.
Well, no, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because I hadn't. You know, I mean, sometimes things are looking at you right, you know, in front of you, and you can't. You know, you say, well, I didn't notice that until now. And so, we've been talking with Emily Auger.
Mm-hmm.
And she augurs well, I think, for the future. Maybe not. We'll see. If she's too nice to all these people, if she can get what she needs, I hope she does. And I should also add that you're speaking for yourself rather than for SOS. Is that accurate? Are you a representative of SOS?
I'm an SOS representative.
You are an SOS rep for this. So we can blame SOS for everything you say if we want. So we can say you are, in fact, passing on the party line, so to speak.
For things that I said. Yeah, I take responsibility for what I say.
Right. Appreciate your coming in.
Thank you.
And if you want a hug, I'm just right over here, okay? Keep that in mind.
I will keep that in mind. If you would like to have me back to talk about things like overdose and our overdose education prevention survival project, and maybe the new 911 Good Samaritan law, which Steve Clark also thinks is enabling drug users. That's a very interesting and timely topic to discuss.
Clark actually think is my question. Forgive me, I have to throw a few of those out. I'd like to have you back on that at some point. In fact, I think you should do a regular show on free radio. You get somebody from SOS to do that.
I used to, and I would be happy to do it again.
Uncle Dennis here is keeping the books, and if you kick down, what is it, 35 a month? You can probably get in. Just go to freakradio.org. This is true for anybody else listening. You get an application by going to that site and, you know, come to a meeting and, you know, hey.
Yeah, I remember how, because we used to have a show called the 4140 show, but we couldn't have that name now because the changes in syringe possession laws. So we'd have to come up with a new name.
4140 used to mean what?
That was the code for syringe possession, illegal syringe possession. Now you can have up
to 30, have gotten a little better, in other words.
Yeah, so we could probably come up with a better name as well.
All right.
But, yeah,
listen, thank you very much. Coming up next is From the Cream to the Dregs. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you very much.
Come again, please. And
okay.
People can reach you at the following phone number.
431-7138 or emily.auger@gmail.com or check out our website at www.shootclean.org.
And that's it for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. We've had a one-issue show, but I think it's been an interesting one. I'll be back on Sunday, presumably, and that'll be at 9:30 in the morning. We'll have lots of this, lots of that, and hopefully we'll have you back again, too, Emily, on those some of those issues you've mentioned. Maybe doing your own show. It'd be cool if you could.
Sure, sure. Just let me know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got to let us know. You got to apply, and then you can, you know... They'll get your show if you apply and you kick down $35 a month. You'll get your show.
Okay,
I'm pretty sure.
You can manage
when you
that.
Agree, Dennis.
Yeah,
I think so. That's it for Bathrobe. And as you can hear, I'm breaking down and breaking up. And breaking up is hard to do, as we all know. So
just leave.
Uncle Dennis is using his usual firm approach. And thanks again for coming in. Do you want to ride?
Oh, I'm fine.
Okay.
Thank you very much, though.
All right. Thank you for coming. Go for it, Dennis. The mic is yours.
Well, I just want to say you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. It's time for From the Cream to the Dregs.
Sounds.